don't neglect the assignment up here. Two out of three items I've written on the board. Read Longman chapter 1. You've read chapter 6 to 8. Now it's time to read chapter 1. I have a strange method of reading books, but I actually, I'd like to lecture on it in a certain order, and he wrote his book in a different order. So read Longman chapter 1. Read Matthews and Benjamin, Old Testament parallels, pages 153 to 175. And continue reading the Psalms. One person asked, what does that mean to be reading the Psalms? The idea is that you should be immersing yourself in the Psalms before we begin talking about them this coming week. Next week will be, that is this coming week, we will be talking about the Psalms. Which brings me to the other comment or question. Someone said, is it all going to be this theoretical? Or she didn't put it exactly that way, but I knew what she meant. Is it all going to be this complicated and sort of abstract? Well, no. And believe me, you know, the knock-knock jokes were not all that abstract. But no, we will. You have to kind of learn some of this stuff, or at least it's useful to learn it and talk about it before we start involving ourselves with the texts. But we will begin doing that next week, and that will be our constant practice then thereafter. We'll be dealing with first the Psalms for several weeks, then we'll talk about Proverbs and then Job and so forth. But this is meant to help us be better students of the Word. And after all, we have a corpus of material to cover in this course that it would be impossible to cover adequately, talking about every psalm, talking about every proverb, talking about every aspect of the book of Job. So part of what we try to do here at Covenant Seminary is teach you to fish. You know, you've heard the example, I can give you a platter of fish and you can eat for a week and then you'll be hungry. But if I teach you to fish, you can live for, you can feed yourself then for a lifetime. So the idea is to help you learn to be a better student of Scripture. And then we'll apply it, certainly, but we won't be able to exhaustively cover the corpus that is our requirement here. So that's part of the strategy. So continue reading the Psalms and do not neglect these other two assignments for next week. Okay? All right, well, we come then to try to finish off. I want to finish off this discussion fairly quickly so that we can reserve maybe 20 minutes at the end of this class for another launching into another group project. Now, this one will not be anything that requires a lot of, won't require much of anything outside of class. Okay, so don't get nervous. He's going to always be giving us these group projects. I think you'll enjoy this, and I think it's good for you guys to interact with one another. Now, on your outline, you see that I have at the top of page 4, point 4, Alter's contribution. Well, that's Robert Alter, who wrote a very influential book entitled The Art of Biblical Narrative, and then he wrote a second book entitled The Art of Biblical Poetry. And it's an interesting book, but I want to abbreviate my treatment. I have a lot of headings here and so forth and so on. But essentially, Alter is moving in the same direction as James Kugel. And as he is at pains to point out in several places in the book, he came to these conclusions independently of James Kugel's work. So he didn't want to be thought of as derivative of what James Kugel was doing. And he did, in fact, I think, arrive at similar conclusions independently of James Kugel. So both of these guys were thinking along the same track, which does lend some credence to the direction in which they were moving. Well, again, his theory is one of dynamic movement. Let me see if I can spot quickly something that would summarize that. As I say, I want to make this as brief as possible. Well, he first of all says that, unfortunately, the notion of semantic parallelism betrays the mistaken notion of a considerable degree of stasis or static quality between poetic lines. And he goes on to talk about the fact that what he sees is something diametrically opposed to that, and that is an argument for dynamic movement from one verset to the next. Okay, I told you he used the term verset. That means Kugel's A, B is his verset 1, verset 2. Right, so he's saying much the same thing. He does, however, go on and he tries to qualify Kugel's work, finds a little problem with it in the sense that he thinks that Kugel is saying every poetic line is an A and what's more B. I'm not so sure Kugel would say that, but Alter thinks he might, and he says you've got to back off of that. Then he says the genius, the heart of semantic parallelism is heightening, sharpening, intensification. And again, that's exactly or very similar to what James Kugel is saying. But he does provide us with some further examples and a little more a little further breakdown. So if you look at page 2 of my handout on parallelism that I gave you, I'll just run us through these quite quickly. And again, the border between these is quite fluid. I will never insistently demand that you say of a poetic line, is this specification or focusing? Because often they're quite overlapping. But I think it's helpful to see at least these examples and you get the idea of what's going on. He says, first of all, there's specification. That's one kind of heightening. I mean, I need my notes here to describe it to you. In specification, the general term occurs in the first line or the first phrase, and a more specific instance of the general term occurs in the second. So look at his example from Proverbs 3:10. Your granaries will be filled with abundance. With new wine, your vats will burst. Well, abundance is the general term. New wine is a specific example of that abundance. See that? Job 41:16, the next example. His heart is as solid as stone, as solid as the nether millstone. That's a rather romantic sounding term. But it's more specific, not just any stone, but the nether millstone. Or the intensification may take the form of focusing, and by that he means the first term is spatial or geographical, and the second is usually a smaller spatial entity. Example, Jeremiah 7:38. I shall put an end in the cities of Judea and in the streets of Jerusalem to the sound of gladness and joy, the sound of bridegroom and bride. Now, the first line is really the example of this. Notice that the cities of Judea, that's a broad geographic region, streets of Jerusalem, that's a focusing in, as if you're coming in for a landing. Okay, first the bird's eye view, then come in for a landing. To the sound of gladness and joy, the sound of bridegroom and bride, that line there might be more along the lines of specification. Okay, you get the general term, gladness and joy, and then a specific kind of gladness and joy. Third possibility, third categorization that Alter gives us, concretization. The general term is transformed into a specific instance or concrete image. Again, you see there's a lot of overlap here. Example, Isaiah 17:1. Look, Damascus will cease to be a city, will become a heap of ruins. Okay, ceasing to be a city, that's rather abstract. We don't know what that looks like. But a heap of ruins, well, that's more concrete. So there's a concrete image introduced. Or Lamentations 1:2, she weeps on through the night, and her tears are on her cheek. Okay, the first is description of a general activity, and the second is a graphic image, a concrete image that we can visualize. And finally, he says, maybe the intensification, the heightening, will take the form of dramatization. Isaiah 49:23, face to the ground they will bow to you, they will lick the dust of your feet. Well, that's pretty dramatic in the second line. Or Job 30:10. They despised me, drew away from me, and from my face they did not hold back their spittle. Again, spitting in one's face. That's again, quite dramatic. And so the second half line is an intensification of what went before. So again, Alter is very much along the same lines as James Kugel, and yet he adds a bit in terms of these kinds of categories that we can think about and be aware of and be looking for. Again, the point is not to categorize things, but to think about what might fit so as more closely to observe what's in the text. Again, during the break, someone was talking about the purpose of labeling terms and so forth. And it is not so that we get all the terms labeled. If that were the point, then someone would have published a book of labeled parallel terms in Hebrew poetry. And we'd all buy the book, put it on our shelves, and never consult it. But that's not the point. The point is, in doing the exercise, it causes us and enables us to observe more closely what is there. So these are observational aids. It's a technique for closer observation. I have a category toward a balanced approach. I think the idea there is get the main point from Kugel and Alter. Don't turn it into an absolute. Don't force every line to involve intensification, because not every line will. And particularly in the Psalms, we have more examples of synonymous parallelism where A equals B. You know, the Lothian view, the second view that that Tremper Longman talks about, A equals B. You have a lot of that in the Psalms. What is interesting, and this is something that Alter points out, where you have that, often the sharpening, the heightening, the intensification is between the lines as you go through the Psalm. You know, there's still sort of a driving intensification that is involved in biblical poetry. Now, that leads us to a question I want to jump to. Evaluation of contributions of Kugel and Alter. I have open to contributions from students. I'm going to just cut that off right now because we don't have time, okay? And think about that. What are some of the pros and the cons? I think maybe we've already said enough that you get my sense that I think there's something of value here. But I want to address this one last question, and then we're going to talk about our little group project. But the question is, what is the importance of poetry in the Old Testament, or to ask it in two different ways, why is it important to recognize poetry? And secondly, why is there so much poetry in the Bible? Why would God choose to include so much? Well, why is it important to recognize poetry? I'll talk about that one. Well, poetry sometimes leaves matters ambiguous, and it's important for us to recognize that and to let them be. Let them be ambiguous. It's also important to recognize the nature of poetry, that it can involve itself in hyperbole or in exaggeration or in imagery or in all kinds of anthropomorphisms and so forth, all kinds of metaphors and similes, and we shouldn't take them in a strictly literal sense. Now, I'm not saying that a poem about a historical event, such as the Song of Deborah, is therefore not of historical import. We can indeed get historical information from the Song of Deborah, but we want to interpret images as images and not to construe them literally if they're not intended to be taken that way. So it's important, just in doing justice to the literature, to recognize when we're dealing with poetry and to recognize the kinds of truth claims it makes. Also, poetry is more emotive than prose. Fee and Stewart, in their good little book, wonderful little book entitled How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth, say that poetry is addressed to the mind through the heart. It's important when we're reading poetry that we engage not simply our minds, and sometimes all this analysis that I encourage you to do can tend to make it purely cerebral. I don't want that to happen in the end. I want you to be able to observe more closely what's happening, what the text is actually saying, so that it can move you in some way, so that it can impress itself upon you in a significant way. It's more emotive than prose, and that leads us to this other question. Why is there so much poetry in the Bible? Why do you think God in His wisdom chose to make this large portion of Scripture to cast it in poetic form? What do you think? Yes, Teresa. It addresses the whole person. It does. It doesn't just address our critical faculties or our minds. Yes, sir? Excellent. It's also more memorable. It's easier to remember poetry because it's maybe a little harder to learn it, but it's very much more memorable. Sometimes the parallelism works in that direction. Yes? Okay, it demonstrates to us God's creative ability and His creative capacity, that in His wisdom He inspired these creative works in Scripture. Donna, was that what you were going to say? Aha. Great minds thinking along the same line there. Yes, Matt. Yes, yes indeed. And that's an interesting point. Even in narrative contexts, often the climactic point is cast in a poetic idiom, in a heightened diction. And again, if you think of some of the best sermons you've heard, can't think of any I preach, but if you think of some of the best sermons you've heard, probably there was some word or phrase that was at the heart of that sermon that was cast in such a way that it was almost poetry. And you went away remembering that because of the careful way in which it was formulated. And that is often the case in biblical narrative, in the historical books. If suddenly the diction, the speech, is elevated to the level of poetry, that's likely to be a very important thing to notice. Of course, the old view was, well, that's from a different source, so we take it out and disregard it and such. But that's wrong thinking. It's elevated diction, and we should give it all the more attention. Yes, Harry. It engages us. Yes, it. Let me give you an example of that, and then we're going to move in just a minute to our project. It's more moving. It does engage us in a different way. Think about Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. Now, compare that to God is revealed in His creation, especially in the heavenly bodies. I mean, I said the same thing after all. I just didn't say it as well. I said it in prose, a proposition which I believe, but it didn't particularly move me in the same way that reading the poetry does. And so, again, that's part of it. One more thing. I said one more. Here's another one. One more thing, and this is a point that Alter makes, which I think is a very interesting point. He says, poetry is a particularly appropriate medium for prayer and for talking about God. And it's because of this A and what's more B idea, this sense of heightening. When we're talking about God and when we're reading a hymn of praise or composing a hymn of praise, it's appropriate that it be in poetry, particularly biblical kind type poetry, because when can you really have said it all? All you're doing is sort of launching the trajectory, A, and what's more B, and we assume what's more C, and what's more D, and what's more E, and all these things that, you know, really go beyond our capacity to express. So he says it's a particularly appropriate idiom for talking about God and for talking to God. Now, I know there are other ideas coming up, but let's move now to our group project. And let me explain, first of all, what I want you to do. We'll take the next 20 or so minutes, and that'll give you time to pack up and be gone on time. In the final handout I gave you today was this Psalm 1 handout. And forgive the Hebrew there. I had the handout already made out, and it's more for my purposes, but I know that there are a few in this class who are doing Hebrew even at this very moment, so they can enjoy this as well. But what I'd like you to do in your group is to take Psalm 1 and simply begin analyzing it, sort of as we've done tonight. Maybe labeling parallel terms. Again, there's not going to be a right or wrong to that. You don't say to me, did we get this right? And I'll look at it and say, well, I'm not sure those are parallel. But it's to make you observe more closely. And I want you to, as a group, work through this psalm, analyzing the psalm, looking for heightening or intensification, and asking, you know, how does that influence me? How does that help me in understanding this poem? And then work toward, also, when you've done that, work toward outlining this psalm. What would be the major breaks? What would be the major sections in this psalm? Okay? Everybody got that pretty well? Do you know your groups? Anyone without a group? Anyone been ejected from a group? Okay, what we're going to do is, here in this class, we're going to break for a small group, so you in video land should do the same thing, assuming there's more than one of you. If there's only one of you, you can talk to yourself.